Blog Talk Radio.
Virginia, where it's a surprisingly pleasant winter day, sitting in the Monday between Christmas and New Year's, staying warm, writing, and going and bringing you another edition of Military Monday. My name is John Gresham. I'm your host, and as I promised a couple of weeks ago, the last couple shows this year are going to be kind of fun shows. Last week we had my good friend Bob Doerr talking about his new book on fighting German jets in World War II. But it's worth noting that the single most popular subject for military history authors, not just over a period of years, but decades and now over a century, has been the American Civil War. Bottom line, there have been more military history books written about the American Civil War than any other subject. World War II, World War I, D-Day, the Revolution. I doubt that they stack up even as many books combined as we see and continue to see about the American Civil War. And of all of the actions in the American Civil War, none has captured the interest, imagination, and maybe even the whimsy of the American public, like the Battle of Gettysburg in the middle of 1863. Fought the first few days of July, it was part of a law of 1863, Gettysburg was a larger campaign that actually began in June and continued on through July afterwards. It was, without question, the largest battle to ever take place on the North American continent. It was the pivotal moment in the American Civil War. And today we have a guest with us that I think you're going to really enjoy. This gentleman is generally considered the grand dean of current Gettysburg authors. He's written five books on the battle and the battlefield, including the standard battlefield guide that if you go to the National Park Service Center and go into their bookstore, this is the book you're most likely to grab. One of the two he's written on the battlefield itself. I'm talking about J. David Petruzzi, who lives in Pennsylvania. He moonlights. His day job is that he's an insurance agent. And David, are you there, sir?
I'm here. How are you, John?
Oh, I'm great. And I have to say, as you know, I have a great fondness for fellow authors who are insurance agents. And it's nice to meet another one.
Yeah, I hope the audience doesn't hate me already.
Oh, I don't know. As I recall, my friend Mr. Clancy sold a few books and made a few friends after he left the insurance industry. Although it was interesting, he maintained his license, I think, right up to his death there earlier this year. Okay, let's ask the first question. Why Gettysburg? What has drawn you to this battle enough to write? You know, I usually have the good sense to quit beating on myself and on a single subject after one book. You've written five.
Yes, exactly. And what you mentioned at the start of the show that and I agree with you, there have been more books about the Civil War than probably, you know, really any other historical period in American history, maybe combined. You know, I'm not sure. Excuse me. I think World War II is really gaining in popularity. So it's probably taking a bigger share, you know, I imagine, in recent years, but probably more on the Civil War and I think without a doubt more on Gettysburg, you know, than anything else. It's like the old saying, a Caspian sea of ink, literally, you know, has been spilled on the Gettysburg battle and the campaign alone. But for me, my interest when I really started getting interested in American history, just when I was a young kid, you know, and kind of discovered cowboys and Indians, you know, when I was 7 or 8 years old. So that's probably where the interest started. And then I kind of discovered that a lot of these American soldiers who fought during the Indian Wars period of the 1870s and 1880s were officers who came out of the Civil War period. So after discovering the Indian Wars and all that interesting stuff, you know, then I discovered the Civil War and started following these officers, you know, through the Civil War. And, of course, I'm talking about guys like Custer, you know, you name it, Sheridan, George Crook, Ranald McKenzie, you know, fellows like that. But my interest really started getting narrowed down to Gettysburg simply because I'm a Pennsylvania resident, you know, and that's close. So for a lot of people, I think, who get interested in the Civil War, they start on Gettysburg, you know. There's more information out there on it than any other battle or campaign, so naturally I just gravitated towards that.
And yet people are writing new Gettysburg books by the dozen every year. How is it that one three-day encounter in south-central Pennsylvania can go and still generate new ideas, new conclusions, new information, literally 150 years after the last gun got fired?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people have heard me say this. I've called pretty much the last, like, decade or last 15 years is the era of the microstudy. You know, and when you look at just a three-day battle like Gettysburg, people are able to write entire books, 300-400-page books, on 10 minutes of action, you know, at Gettysburg. For instance, some of the best studies have come out on, you know, concentrating on, like, the railroad fight in the railroad cut on the first day, July 1st. Or somebody will focus on just Culp's Hill. We know that, you know, one of the, and I think, did you call me one of the great deans of Gettysburg scholars? Was that the term? I wasn't sure if I heard that correct.
Well, you certainly are sort of the guy who's written more that's active than anybody else. And let's face it, your books have really resonated with a lot of readers, and your scholarship has impressed quite a few people, myself included.
Well, no, I appreciate that. And I just sort of think of myself as a simple farm boy just doing what I love, you know, and I just sort of hope that comes through. I hope the passion at least comes through in my writing, you know, and gets others interested. But the ones that I really think of is sort of, you know, quote, the great deans of scholarship, if you're looking just at Gettysburg. For instance, Dr. Harry Fance, who, you know, did several fabulous works, concentrating most recently on the first day. That book came out a number of years ago. That was his last work that he was able to complete. But he concentrated on areas of the battlefield like Cemetery Hill and Culp's Hill, second day actions. People will concentrate on, for instance, Little Round Top, you know, which I know you want to get to later. It's a big interest for people. And a lot of these things, of course, stem out of movies like Gettysburg, you know, got people interested in certain personalities, whether it's General John Buford or Longstreet or Chamberlain, you know, or whatever. And then people have really looked for and clamored for and asked for, I think, these various studies, whether they're biographies or studies of certain areas, the field, or certain actions. And thankfully, you know, scholars and authors out there have been more than willing to do these micro studies, all of which, you know, really enhances our understanding of all these things. You can read some of the great overviews of Gettysburg, whether it's Coddington or Trudeau or Sears or whatever, and then what you want to do, or what a lot of people like to do then, is to delve into those specific actions or geographic areas, you know, that interest them the most.
And let's not kid ourselves. Maybe I haven't met the bad guys, but everybody I've run into in the Civil War scholarship community, they seem to be really nice people. I mean,
yeah.
They like to share. They like to go and share information. They like to share new discoveries, new stuff. I mean, it isn't even like academia. It's more like a big club where we're pushing each other to go that next step and to set the next bar a little higher.
Right, right. No, very good observation. You know, 25 years ago or whatever, when the internet, you know, was really becoming popular and available to everybody. The Civil War community, of course, discovered the internet and all of a sudden discovered things like chat boards, you know, which is where a lot of us got together. And in fact, a lot of those people that I met on chat boards 20 and 25 years ago are some of my best friends today. And that's actually where I make a lot of my new friends, you know, is through this. People that I meet on the internet, all the social media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you know, everybody gravitates towards those people that, that have their same interests. And it is kind of like one big family. You know, the vast majority of my friends on Facebook are members of the Civil War community. You know, either people that I've met, a lot of them that I haven't met, they might be readers of mine. You know, that's where a lot of it comes from. And it is kind of amazing how it kind of takes over your life. You know, I've often said that, yeah, I'm you know, an insurance broker by day, but that flexible schedule is one of those things that basically allows me to put so much effort into my hobby, you know, into that other interest, which is reading and writing and studying. It really does, though. It's like a big spider web, you know. It just totally permeates your entire life. And I center a lot of my vacations, you know, around the Civil War, visiting certain areas. A lot of my pastime, you know, so much of my pastime is devoted to it. And it's amazing how it really takes over. It really, really is.
Well, let's go switch over to your secret superhero historian identity and talk a little bit about this incredible action in southern Pennsylvania in 1863.
Right. I'll put my crimson cape on.
Ooh, crimson cape. We like it. That's the crimson.
A little a la Jeff Stewart.
Hello?
Oh, yes, I'm here. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. And start by saying, why Gettysburg? Why did it happen? When did it happen? What was it sandwiched in between in terms of historic events? And why did it happen where it did? Go ahead and give us the short version.
Okay, well, yeah, let's the quick and dirty on a very, you know, largely encompassing question. Gettysburg, of course, the main battle takes place July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, 1863. And if you look at the calendar of the Civil War, it's pretty much right in the middle. And a lot of people think of it as a turning point of the Civil War, and that's one of the great debates, you know, that people will have about Gettysburg. Did the Civil War take a turn for the worse, for instance, you know, for the Confederacy, or for the better, for the Federal Army? There's a lot of debate about that. It's certainly, and it depends how you define, you know, turning point. But I think in conjunction with things like the fall of Vicksburg, you know, which happens the next day on Independence Day, then I think there are certainly turning points. Vicksburg is something that chokes off the Mississippi, you know, for the Confederacy. So you can't look at the two in a vacuum. I think if you looked at the two together, then it certainly was a turning point. So, but it's sandwiched in between, obviously, the very embarrassing federal defeat at Chancellorsville in early May of 1863. After Gettysburg is to a lot of people, the rather obscure and uninteresting, you know, Mine Run campaign. The campaigns of the fall of 1863. It kind of seems like after Gettysburg, everybody sort of skips over, you know, the rest of the year and gets right into 1864 with the advent of U.S. Grant and his campaigns of 1864. But so it's right in the middle of the Civil War. How the armies get there, you know, and why the Battle of Gettysburg happened, I've always said that if anybody goes out there and stands at Gettysburg and looks at the terrain, the geography, you know, surrounding the town, if a Civil War battle didn't happen there, it should have. You couldn't bring in hundreds of backhoes and earth movers and equipment and create a better Civil War battlefield for the way it happened. And the battle progressed.
There's all the roads. Yeah. How many roads come in the square in the middle of Gettysburg, and from how
many
places?
Just like the spokes on a wheel, right. Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it was a place where Robert E. Lee said, okay, all the roads come together there. Let's go there and concentrate and go on from there.
Well, yeah, to a certain point. They, you know, both sides recognized, if not before the battle, certainly as it progressed, the road network to the town. But the one thing you have to remember is really Gettysburg itself, the town itself, was really of no military significance. You know, so it's not like either army is rushing to Gettysburg as it was in the summer of 1863 to protect it for any reason. It didn't have any value, no military value whatsoever. What really drove the armies ending up being there, and then the way the battle progresses over the 3 days, is the terrain that surrounds Gettysburg itself. Robert E. Lee, you know, he did want to go into Pennsylvania. This was his second invasion after the halted invasion of the fall of 1862, which culminates in the Battle of Antietam down in Maryland. He wanted and proposed a plan to take his army into Pennsylvania to get the Civil War and the depredations and, of course, the damage and everything that was being done in Virginia, which, you know, really had shouldered most of the military actions of the Civil War up until this point, and, of course, would shoulder them, you know, all over again many times over after the Battle of Gettysburg. But he intended to try to meet various elements of the Federal Army and defeat them in piecemeal. And also made some risky maneuvers himself in dividing his army as he marches north. His three corps, of course, he's got three corps after the death of Stonewall Jackson, you know, following the Battle of Chancellorsville, breaks them up and moves into Pennsylvania and intends to threaten the Pennsylvania capital at Harrisburg. But again, like I said, one of his main objectives was to meet the Federal Army in pieces and defeat it in pieces, because he knew, I believe, standing toe-to-toe with the bulk of both armies together, unless the ground was really, really in his favor, he stood no chance of having a complete and crushing defeat, you know, and finally in the Civil War.
In other words, he could find another situation like Fredericksburg the previous December. He wasn't going to try and take the entire Union Army on at a single battle.
Right. Right, exactly. He had already wonderful successes, you know, against the odds, being outnumbered. You know, whether you're looking at Antietam, which is strategically a federal victory because they held the field, you know, afterwards. But McClellan, you know, did not commit his entire force, but still outnumbered. You know, the vaunted Confederate army did extremely well at Antietam. But I think he knew standing toe-to-toe against an army larger than his, and Lee did know that, you know, that unless the ground was really, really in his favor, and the Federals did a lot of stupid things, you know, that he could not defeat the army unless he could meet the Federals in pieces. Neither side, though, ever intended to concentrate at Gettysburg and fight a major battle there. Lee did
not. It's worth noting that the Federals had done stupid things through a series of commanders, McClellan, McDowell,
sure,
Hooker,
Burnside.
And Burnside.
Right.
Up until that point, nobody had ever come up to Robert E. Lee and even shown much of a backbone to him at this point.
Well, you know, and there are a lot of people who would agree with that, and I think there's a very telling remark in what Robert E. Lee says about George Meade when he hears right before the battle then ends up breaking out at Gettysburg. You know, people haven't given it a whole lot of weight, but I think it really bears looking at. With what you just said, with what all of the Federal Army commanders before, going all the way back to McDowell, you know, in the beginning of the war, what had happened, with the decisions, the things that these Federal Army commanders have done, whether you're looking at Fredericksburg, you're looking at Chancellorsville or whatever, what Lee says about Meade that we have recorded is he said he will not make a mistake in my front, number one. So he's making a very telling comparison with George Meade, you know, which he knew before the war, of course. You know, they knew each other decently well. They were friends, and he also knew that Meade was a methodical engineer, and he would probably bring that thinking to his command. So he says that, number one, and he says number two, but he will exploit any mistake that I make in his front. And that, again, is very telling. You know, you can see the contrast between the way he feels about Meade and how Lee sized up the federal commanders that he had faced up to that point. Very, very telling.
The irony of this, of course, being that Lee respected Meade a whole lot better than anybody in Washington, D.C., be it the Secretary of War, the Chief of Staff of the Army, or even the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, at this point.
Sure, sure. I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. He did say, you know, later, in if what some of the recordings we have are true, that he did have respect for McClellan, but I think a lot of that was based on McClellan's ability to organize his army. And, of course, that was one of his great faults. You know, McClellan was such a good organizer and was able to put such a great army together that he was, to quote, I think, another source, afraid to break it, you know. And that's why he was so slow and so cautious. And McClellan, of course, always thought that he was outnumbered, you know, by the Confederates, when, of course, the opposite was true. So.
And let's not kid ourselves. The description of General Meade, a Pennsylvania man, previously the commander of the U.S. 5th Corps, a snapping turtle, I believe is what's how he's described.
Goggle-eyed snapping turtle, I think is the way one observer described him. Yeah, and I remember Lincoln saying, you know, that maybe Meade will fight good on his own dunghill, you know, which is a great colloquial phrase, very characteristic of Abraham Lincoln, you know, basically stating
and,
that.
One thing is for certain, nobody ever thought that George Meade was not tough, was not persistent, and downright ruthless when he needed to be.
Yes, and we have reminiscences just like that from the officers who served under him. A couple were senior to him, you know, he wasn't the most senior commander. There's some debate about whether, you know, John Reynolds, for instance, was formally offered command. He may have been, he may not have been. You know, he told one family member, I believe a sister of his, that he was offered command, or at least that's what the sister said, you know, after his death. But regardless, all of those, even the ones who were senior to Meade, as far as rank, respected him and were very willing to serve under him. So...
And it's worth also noting that this change of command happened in the middle of the march up to Pennsylvania by the Army of the Potomac.
Right.
In the middle of the night, an aide comes in, talks to Meade, and Meade initially wants to know if he's under arrest.
Right, right. He thinks he's under arrest. Yes. Yep. And then he points up.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Please.
Go ahead. You know,
oh, please.
Say,
go ahead.
Initially thinks he's under arrest, and then, you know, in one letter to his wife or maybe something that he says to someone, you know, that now he's looking at this big elephant, basically, that's been placed on his shoulders and, you know, and what he's going to do to it but or do with it. But, of course, being that methodical, logical engineer that he is, what does Meade do right away? Right away he sets to work consulting with Hooker, you know, number one, but then finding out where all the different elements of the army are located, and he sets to work to concentrate his army, and once he finds out and learns that Lee is moving north, chases after him. And in fact, it's a bit of a surprise to Lee, you know, who's really shocked to learn just a couple of days before the battle that the Army of the Potomac is actually north and moving north of the Potomac River. That was a bit of a surprise. So he moves with great alacrity.
And one of the reasons for that surprise is Lee doesn't have his cavalry. His famous cavalry commander, the young J.E.B. Stuart, has decided and convinced him to go on one of his famous rides around the Union Army up into Maryland and other places. And so Lee only has a fraction of his cavalry, and that means he doesn't have his eyes and ears, whereas the Union cavalry has suddenly found itself and is fighting brilliantly up through the march.
And it's a great segue to get into Stuart and the cavalry. Again, one of the great debates, you know, about the Gettysburg campaign and the Civil War as a whole, and something, you know, is Jeb Stuart directly or indirectly responsible for the Confederate defeat at Gettysburg, you know, thus leading into that supposed grand turning point of the war. Lee actually had just under half of the Confederate cavalry with him, so it was still a sizable portion. Jeb Stuart took a little over half, about 5,500 of his troopers, but it needs to be remembered that he took three brigades under his three best commanders. Some people criticize, you know, Stuart for that, but I've always said, I mean, if you're going to field a team initially, you know, and you're going to operate in enemy territory, if you're going to be disconnected from your main army, are you going to take your A team or your D team? You know, of course you're going to take your best commanders. But then I think some fault lies with Lee in the fact that he still had nearly half of the Confederate cavalry with him. And a couple of really good commanders, you know, William Edmondson Jones, known as Grumble Jones, a general in command of what was known as the Laurel Brigade, Colonel or General Turner Ashby's old, you know, Virginia Cavalry Brigade, was even in the words of Jeb Stuart, who Stuart and Jones absolutely hated each other, but Stuart admitted that Jones was one of the best outpost and reconnaissance cavalry officers that he ever knew. They despised each other. Jones, you know, was very businesslike. He just hated the, you know, the foppish cavalier attitude that Jeb Stuart had and the way he dressed and so forth. But they recognized each other's talents. Lee still had two full cavalry brigades and a demi brigade of North Carolina soldiers under General Beverly Robertson. Robertson, you know, we don't want to spend a whole lot of time on him. Probably not one of the best commanders or you know, reconnaissance officers, and I think Lee recognized that. But people do fault Lee for the lead-up to the Gettysburg Battle for perhaps not using his cavalry in the way that he could have, you know, and I think there's something to be said for that. And, in fact, if you're interested in a book on the subject, I have one that I can sell you. There's a little plug. Referencing Plenty of Blame to Go Around. It's a book that my good friend and fellow cavalry enthusiast, Eric Wittenberg, we wrote together, and it was released back in 2006. And it deals all with Jeb Stuart's ride to Gettysburg.
And among the scholarship community, you caused a bit of a ruckus because, of course, the Jeb Stuart supporters really came after you. But we'll deal with politics and Civil War scholarship another time.
Sure, sure.
Obviously, on the early morning of July 1st, both armies, which were trying to concentrate, began to run into each other near Gettysburg. Let's talk a little bit about that part of the battle, because here's the thing. We just came out of the 150th anniversary of the battle this past July, as well as the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. And these were really big to-dos. I mean, these were media events. These were big events, correct?
They were, yeah, very much. I was down in Gettysburg on July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of the anniversary. And I'll just, as sort of a tangential, you know, thing to mention, I was doing a television interview for the hour just before, you know, they did the reenactment of Pickett's Charge. And it wasn't so much reenactors, but just even you know, just folks, civilians that wanted to walk the charge. When I came out of the makeshift TV studio, which was right up there on Cemetery Ridge on the federal line, and stepped out and watched, you know, as the people started walking, I it was unbelievable that I was told in the National Park Service estimates where there were about 25,000 people, you know, standing just there, with somewhere around 6,000 or 8,000. That walked Pickett's Charge. Now, there were probably about 12,500 or 13,000 Confederates that actually made the charge. So this, for me, in all the years that I've been going to Gettysburg, that's the most people I've ever seen walk it at one time. And they were literally the one-mile length from end to end that the original Pickett's Charge on July 3rd, 1863, would have been. And, in fact, just even talking about it, I'm getting a little choked up because you couldn't stand there and watch that absolute mass of humanity and not get a sense of what it must have been like to actually stand there 150 years ago, you know, from that day to actually watch it. And I just stood there in awe, and I don't think I moved or said anything for probably 15 or 20 minutes just watching those people. But if you can imagine, you know, the amount of people that almost will fill a football stadium, all standing in that one area, either participating or watching, and it was just unbelievable. So, yeah, very, very well attended, and so many people there that, again, like I said, maybe one of the unintended consequences was that it really gave you a sense of the mass of humanity that descended on that little town 150 years ago, you know, and what it meant. Really something, really something.
So the big event has come and gone. The 150th anniversary celebrations and commemorations are moving, into Tennessee and Virginia and Georgia next year.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a lot of groovy stuff up there at Gettysburg for people to see. There's a lot of things that most people don't take the time to look at because they just don't know it's there. Now,
right.
Obviously, one way to get a better sense of the battlefield is perhaps if you went to the gift shop and bought, say, a state-of-the-art, highly organized battlefield guide, if there were such a thing in the world, right?
If there were, let me see if I can think of one. Yes, I can.
Obviously, you've written the battlefield guide that's been for sale for a few years there now, and that's
right.
One good way for people to go and learn about places they probably don't know about on the battlefield. But I'm going to go and take you through each day of the battle, and let's talk a little bit about day one and the things that most people don't know to do once they finish up the guided tour at the Visitor Center for the National Park Service. And let's start with the fact, day one is all about a guy named John Buford in a lot of ways. Talk a little bit about John Buford, what he did that day, and where you would find the places where he did what he did on July 1st.
Sure. John Buford has long been one of my heroes. He's one of the fellows that I discovered, you know, early on when I really started getting interested in the cavalry, which is really my concentration. And again, that comes out of the Cowboys and Indians era, you know, that I studied first. He was a Kentucky-born Union loyalist. In the summer of 1863 at Gettysburg, he was only 37 years old, and that surprises a lot of people. They think he was older. The pictures of so many of those guys, you know, during the Civil War, they looked so much older, you know, than they really were. And I think a lot of that is due to the life that he led up until then, you know, the exposure, the hard riding. He was a West Point graduate, was in the pre-war Civil War cavalry in the Dragoons, as it was known, and basically rose through the ranks as a lower officer. But again, like I said, at Gettysburg, he's 37 years old. Physically, he's not in great shape. You know, we get a lot of our impressions of Buford because it's made such a big impact from the movie Gettysburg, you know, and Sam Elliott's wonderful portrayal. And I think he really captured his personality very well. But at Gettysburg, by that time, Buford had already been suffering from the effects of really bad arthritis and, in fact, could not even mount a horse without assistance. He had to be lifted up in the saddle. And again, this is a 37-year-old kid, you know, really, the way a lot of us think of somebody that age. Those of us who have already passed that, you know, back in our older days. But one thing about John Buford was he had the training and the experience, and I think the good old common horse sense, you know, to observe what was going on around him, and had an incredible knack for processing the intelligence that he and his men brought. And in fact, a lot of it was not used very well. In late 1862 and early 1863, when he could have really made a difference in the way, you know, some of the battles ended up going for the Federal Army. But he's ordered up to the Gettysburg area, you know, a couple of days before Gettysburg actually happens. And he has just two of his three brigades with him. There are two brigades of volunteers, but they're good. You know, most of them are veterans. He has two good commanders under him, two colonels named Gamble and Devon. He makes a little detour in the Fairfield area back on the morning of June the 30th because he runs into some Confederates of A.P. Hill's corps, in fact, that are camped there. And that's one of the early indications that John Buford has that the Confederates are so close to the Gettysburg area and are there in force. So he disengages from a little skirmish that happens there on that morning, marches back down into Maryland, and then comes up to Gettysburg via the Emmitsburg Road. you know, one of the famous roads that comes into Gettysburg that that everybody knows today. When he arrives in Gettysburg, he then sees another element of Confederates, and this is General Johnson Pettigrew's brigade, which is making a foray to Gettysburg that morning, June the 30th, and gets a second indication of just how concentrated the Confederates are in that area. Those Confederates wisely pull back and go back to the Cashtown area. But again, by this time, John Buford has information of those Confederates off to the west. By the time he gets into Gettysburg and starts interviewing citizens that are there, you know, who are very happy to give him all the information on Confederates who had been through the area several days prior, elements of Ewell's Corps, Early's division, which moved through Gettysburg on June the 26th. By the end of the day, June 30th, and again, this is the day before the battle will break out on July 1st, we know from the reports that John Buford sends back to Meade and his wing commander, John Reynolds, and the Cavalry Corps commander, General Alpha Pleasanton, that Buford knows that day where every single one of the three Confederate corps are located in south-central Pennsylvania, every single one.
And this is Meade's entire army. He knows.
Yes.
He has situational awareness on every major unit in Lee's army at this point.
Yes, correct. He knows that A.P. Hill, because he's run into their men twice now, he knows that A.P. Hill's corps is camped over in the Cashtown area. Longstreet is behind him, and I'm basically quoting, you know, almost literally from the reports that Buford sends later that day. He knows wherever Longstreet is, who else is there? Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee typically travels and spends most of his time with Longstreet's headquarters. So he knows those two corps are off to the west and the northwest. And he knows that north and northeast of the Gettysburg area is the other corps under General Richard Ewell, because he gets information from the people, the citizens of the area, as well as his scouts, that his corps had moved through Gettysburg, like I said, back on June the 26th, and is heading off towards the Susquehanna, which was Ewell's original orders to threaten Harrisburg, you know, in that area. There are still some of Ewell's stragglers north of Gettysburg in the area of Hunterstown and other areas. So by the time he sends those reports later that day, he literally puts on paper exactly where each one of those three Confederate corps are, and it turns out he was exactly right.
So the night before the battle, he basically goes north and northeast of Gettysburg, puts his people astride the roads coming from the north and the northeast, sends word to John Reynolds and the rest of the army, and finds himself some good ground to go ahead and sit on. What does he want to do on the morning of July 1st, and what does he do? Talk a little bit about the ground he sits on, and what if you go out there today, what are you going to see?
Well, what he sets up, and my good friend and co-author, I also wrote a book with this fellow, he's a retired armored cavalry officer. His name is Michael Nugent, lives up in Maine. And he has studied, you know, cavalry tactics and how they relate to modern warfare in detail. And what the federal or the what the United States Army calls today that John Buford set up 150 years ago, and he wasn't the only one. You know, others had done this similar thing, and it's best done with cavalry outposts. It's called a covering force action. And what Buford did was he used that terrain that was west of Gettysburg and north of Gettysburg, those ridges. It's basically a series. If you look at a spider web and you imagine the center of the spider web being the town of Gettysburg, and then the parallel lines or, you know, or whatever of the spider web that sort of radiate out, kind of like a, you know, a semicircle, basically matches those ridges that are west and north of Gettysburg. So what Buford does is he uses each one of those ridges going all the way out, nearly 4 miles from the town of Gettysburg itself to the west, all the way out those ridges to a ridge known today as Knoxland Ridge, and sets up outposts every so often. In fact, they comprise an arc starting down at where the Fairfield Road radiates out several miles from Gettysburg, swinging west of Gettysburg to the north, and then northeast all the way over to the Hanover Road. He sets up cavalry outposts in an arc that stretches nearly 7 miles. And their duty is to watch to the west and the north and northeast all of those roads raiding out in those directions. And why in those directions? Because that's where he pegs the three Confederate corps, to the west and to the north, and watches each one of those roads. John, a chipmunk, would not have gotten to Gettysburg from the west or the north on the morning of July 1st, 1863, without John Buford knowing about it. You know, that's what he set up. And it was literally an early alarm, you know, warning system. If there was an enemy approach on any of those roads or in any of those areas, what those cavalry outposts, and they were basically groups of two and three, they're commanded by a non-commissioned officer, sergeant, corporal, and so forth. Whenever they saw the approach of the enemy, they were then to send up the alarm back to what's called a reserve post behind them. Okay, in the case of the Chambersburg Pike, to get specific, if you look at today's Route 30, the Chambersburg or Cashtown Pike, which is where we know General Harry Heath, you know, first advances on Gettysburg that morning of July 1st with his division, the what's called the reserve outpost was located halfway between that initial outpost on Knoxon Ridge and the town of Gettysburg at a place called Hers Ridge, and specifically the Hers Tavern. So when those troopers out on Knoxon Ridge saw Heath advance, one of them gets on his horse, gallops back to Hers Ridge, and he tells his commission officer there, in this case a lieutenant, that the Confederates are coming. That commission officer then sends up the alarm back to Buford's main camps towards Gettysburg along Seminary Ridge, and they send up the alarm to both brigades. So it's basically like sort of a smoke alarm, you know, where it sends up the alarm and then all the activity starts taking place. That's exactly what happened on the morning of July 1st. And Buford predicted it. He told one of his officers, if the reminiscence is correct, and I believe it is, that he felt he was going to be attacked in the morning. Everything pointed towards it, everything that he had seen. You know, if there was going to be an attack, it was going to be on his position on the morning of July 1st, and he had predicted it to one of his officers. And, of course, that's exactly what happened.
Now, we need to move this along, but let's just say over the next few hours, he was able to go and hold up not only the forces coming down the Cashtown Pike, but also the forces north of him, and he bought a critical 4 or 5 hours while John Reynolds and other corps commanders began to come up. And in a very real way, John Buford decides for everybody where that battle is going to take place and how the battle lines are going to be laid out. He goes and picks the place and the time for the Battle of Gettysburg, which is pretty audacious for a little brigadier general with arthritis and less than 6 months to live.
He does, and you know he really doesn't get enough credit for it. It's one of the things that I do constantly talk about. When we look at the Battle of Gettysburg, I mean, the Congress gave the Medal of Honor to General Howard, Oliver Howard, later on, you know, for selecting the battlefield. And in technical aspects, you know, and when Howard came on the field, he was the senior officer in command at that point, and, you know, does then officially set up the Army's headquarters on Cemetery Hill. So technically, yes, but really initially, and you're exactly right, it's Buford that selects that ground. And he selects it by setting up his troopers the way he does, by conducting that delaying action, meeting Heath's advance and holding him back for several hours, you know, so that the Federal Army can basically come in and replace him and, you know, set up on all those positions that Buford himself had occupied. But one thing that really bears exposing is the fact that he also passed that on to John Reynolds when he came on the ground. When Reynolds arrived a little bit after 10 o'clock that morning, and of course he's only going to live about another half hour, you know, before he's mortally wounded and dies, the highest ranking federal officer to be killed at Gettysburg, he turns to John Reynolds shortly upon his arrival on the field and points back to the area of Cemetery Hill. And this is Buford now. And he tells John Reynolds, pointing to Cemetery Hill, that's where the Army belongs. Those were his specific words. Reynolds looked back at it and apparently agreed. So it was John Buford early that morning who told John Reynolds that really what we're doing is we're saving this ground, we're slowing the Confederate advance down so that we can set up on Cemetery Hill. And then later on, it's Buford who was also assisting guys like Hancock and Howard in setting up that ultimate defense along Cemetery Hill and Cemetery Ridge. So, yes, it's Buford that picks it and tells the other officers that this is why we're doing what we're doing. And the ground that we need to be set up on, you know, which is good ground for us, is the area of Cemetery Hill and Cemetery Ridge. So Buford deserves the initial credit for selecting that battlefield and for the way it ends up playing out over the next 3 days.
Which, as it is said that Buford said, there'll be the devil to pay. And with
yes.
that, I'd like to take a quick break for some network messages, and we'll talk about a few other places on the battlefield for people to see after the 150th anniversary. This is John Gresham for Military Monday, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Right Stream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
And with that, we are back on Military Monday. If you're interested in calling in and talking to JD or myself, our call-in number is 347-945-7246. Again, that call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. And JD, are you still with me, sir?
I'm here.
Let's go ahead and jump forward to the second day of the battle, July 2nd. And in this particular case, much of the action shifts over to the right side or southern end of the battlefield and is focused on a move by General Longstreet's corps to try and get around the right side of the Federal line as they were looking at it. Now, this area was covered mostly by the 3rd Corps under a political general by the name of Dan Sickles, and was beginning to be covered on the southern end by General Meade's old corps, the U.S. 5th Corps, which was just coming up from the south. And all of a sudden, in the morning, as the Confederates begin to move out, General Sickles, not a man noted for his judgment or discretion, does something really stupid. Talk a little bit about that and what happens to the battle the rest of the day as a result of that movement.
Well, again, you know, Sickles' move is one of those great debates about Gettysburg, and you talk to any group about it, and I think you'll find about half of them that think it was a really stupid move, you know, and half who look at it as something that obviously greatly affects the way Longstreet's assault is going to progress on that part of the field. Kind of working back just a little bit, the whole controversy sort of starts with what's known as the reconnaissance of an officer who was serving as an engineer on Lee's staff, Captain Samuel Johnston. And he was ordered very early in the twilight hours of July 2nd to make a reconnaissance in that area south of the field and take a look at the left of the federal line, you know, to see where they were. And to make a long story short, he comes back and reports to Lee that there are no federal troops in the area of what we know today as the Round Tops. You know, whether he actually got there or not is food for that controversy. We don't know exactly where he may have went, and there's a lot of arguments, you know, about that. But anyway, he reports that there are no troops there. Of course, this entire situation changes later that afternoon as General Sickles grows more and more unsatisfied with the line that he is assigned. And that is pretty much on the left of Hancock's Second Corps, going south on Cemetery Ridge and then leading to Little Round Top. A lot of that ground in that area is rather low. And some say this harkens back to Sickles' experience at Chancellorsville and in that area, Hazel Grove and so forth. You know, they had low ground and really took a pounding there, and that he did not want to duplicate what happened to him at Chancellorsville at Gettysburg with this low ground. Sickles looks out to his west, and he sees this much higher ground out in the area of, you know, the Peach Orchard and the Emmitsburg Road. Sends back several times to Meade for him or somebody to come look at the ground, you know, and see if he can move forward. Brigadier General Henry Hunt, Meade's artillery commander, comes out once and somewhat agrees, you know, with Sickles that maybe there is better ground out in his front, but he's not going to order Sickles, you know, on his authority for him to move. In the end, Sickles does move about three-quarters of a mile from his assigned line all the way out to the Emmitsburg Road and really stretches his small corps in that area, creating an apex in the area of what we know as the Peach Orchard. And this is basically the point of kind of like an inverted triangle, you know, pointing towards the Confederate line. So he's got a very long front that he has to cover with rather few men. And he has that apex, that point out there where he can now be attacked on two fronts. And this is literally what happened.
And it's worth noting that visitors today, literally in their cars, can go and drive up that road from the south and see all of the terrain that was in back of it that he moved out of into the open right up to the road line, correct?
Yes, and thank goodness for the management plan, you know, that the park has instituted the last few years with cutting down a lot of the non-historic tree lots. I think something like 600 acres total, you know, has been cut or is planned to be cut. And we can now drive up over, you know, top of a Little Round Top and then go down sort of in that swale, you know, that Sickles did not like. But in between Little Round Top, sort of the southern point of the line where he was to be covering, and then heading towards, say, for instance, the area of the Pennsylvania Monument, you know, as you're coming up Hancock Avenue. Right in the middle there, in that low ground, though, is a knoll, a small hill. It's called Munshauer's Hill, which is very advantageous terrain. You know, and we never could see that until a couple of years ago when they cut down all those trees. You never really could get a good feel for it. But now that we can actually see that terrain devoid of trees the way it was in 1863, you get a really good idea. And it's kind of changed the argument. A lot of people will go there today now, you know, and look at Little Round Top. They'll look at Munshauer Hill. They will notice sort of that low ground that Sickles didn't like, but they'll start shaking their heads and they'll think, why in the world did he ever move off of this ground? You know, so it has kind of changed the dynamics of the argument about Sickles' move.
Now, of course, there's just a huge and bloody fight there that goes on all afternoon. And it generally is kind of indecisive there. But over on the bottom of the line, on the south end, John Bell Hood and his units begin to start turning the end of the federal line. And this is where a series of events happens that leads to what most people think may have been one of the greatest actions in the history of the U.S. Army. Strong, Governor Kay Warren, one of Meade's engineering officers, sees there's nothing down there. And it's starting to look like Longstreet and Hood are starting to push out on that right side. And so he immediately goes and starts putting elements of 5th Corps, particularly the brigade of one young officer, Strong Vincent, in there.
Right.
And at the very end of that line, in the saddle, right on the edge of the saddle between Little Round Top and Big Round Top to its south, they stick an understrength regiment from Maine, commanded by a teacher, a professor, not even a West Point officer, a guy who dealt in rhetoric but wanted to be an officer, a young man named Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. Talk about the place on Little Round Top where he made his stand and what they did.
Sure. And let me just preface it by saying that actually July 2nd, the second day, is the bloodiest of the 3 days. If you look at the casualty counts, a lot of people aren't aware of that, you know, because everything about the third day in Pickett's charge really overshadows it. But when you combine everything that happens on the southern end of the line with Longstreet's assault and also the massive casualties that take place up on Culp's Hill and the wheat field, you know, the Rose Farm in particular, and everything that happens with Sickles out in the Peach Orchard area, really the second day is the bloodiest day. Down there in sort of like that swale that you're talking about between the Round Tops, there's just a little bump. And people are very surprised how small that little knoll is and how that area actually is. Watching,
incredibly small little piece of real estate to fight the decisive action of this battle.
Right.
There it is.
And it looks so much bigger in the movie Gettysburg. You know, when people look at that fabulous, you know, depiction of the action down there with Chamberlain, of course, played by Jeff Daniels. You know, it looks so much bigger. And people are really surprised, I think, when they, you know, look at that little area where the 20th Maine set up literally in the nick of time, you know, to receive Brigadier General Evander Laws and the Alabamians attack in that area. They're really surprised how small it is. But on this small little knoll, as you mentioned, Strong Vincent, Chamberlain's division commander, you know, comes over, and, or brigade commander, I'm sorry, puts Chamberlain and the men of the 20th Maine, and just a couple of weeks before that, you know, some men of the 2nd Maine came in and bolstered Chamberlain's ranks. But just those few hundred are placed in that area, and Vincent lets Chamberlain know that he's the end of the line. You know, this is it, and we need to hold this ground at all costs. We can get into in a minute if you want to, you know, the big debate about whether if the Confederates had captured Little Round Top, what really would it have meant. But all of that aside, it's amazing the stand that his men and the 20th Maine put up in that area against those concentrated attacks, you know, by a superior force under the Confederates. And they hit in certain areas. The Alabamians and the other Confederates continuously move off to the east and keep attacking Chamberlain's line, forcing him to keep extending his line, and he's already undermanned in that area to begin with, and then refuse the left part of his line, which is wonderfully depicted in the area. He basically creates an apex, you know, of his own to try to protect that little portion of the hill. By the time the Confederates make several attacks and are repulsed, almost everybody's out of ammunition on both sides. And the great bayonet charge that we all know, you know, that the Chamberlain's men perform was really something more out of exasperation and not something that was specifically ordered by Chamberlain. You know, the Gettysburg students who are really into this know that actually Chamberlain did not specifically order a bayonet charge. Some of the men started going forward, and they thought that they were going down to try to rescue some of their wounded comrades. And all of a sudden, you know, everybody got into the action. So when Chamberlain ordered everybody to fix bayonets, the charge almost took on a life of its own and almost happened by itself. And then they make this grand charge down the hill into Confederates, which admittedly were already starting to retreat. You know, they had admitted that. But when all was said and done and everything was over, they did successfully protect that part of the hill, that part of the line. And it's something that people, I think, you know, do need to recognize that sacrifice and that bravery, which took place down there. Now, whether it really, you know, made a huge difference in the grand scheme of things, you know, is open to debate. But any act of bravery, large or small, is worth noting.
And no matter what people may think, this professor of rhetoric and other subjects,
mm-hmm.
who later would be recognized with the Medal of Honor and be governor of the state of Maine.
And given the honor at the surrender of Appomattox, too, to receive the surrender. Yes, quite an honor.
Arguably one of the greatest citizen soldiers in the history of this country.
Right.
He put up a stubborn and brilliant defense that, as you point out, students still argue and have fistfights over in bars up at West Point. I mean, this is something mm-hmm. that people are emotionally invested in. I have a good friend who's a war game designer and supervisor at the Air Force Research Lab out at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, whose wife got her doctorate on Civil War history. And the joke that Matt Caffrey likes to say is, I have a problem. My wife is unfaithful to me. She's in love with another man. The good news is it's Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, and he's been dead 100 years.
If you go up to his grave today, you will find love notes left, you know, on his gravestone. People will leave, of course, you know, coins and so forth, you know, for remembrance and, you know, and good luck and so forth. But women by the dozens still leave love notes on his gravesite. Isn't that something? You know, I mean, what does that say, I guess, about, you know, the way people
back,
look at it? And think of...
A few years back, I had the pleasure of going and doing a little research for a documentary film company over at the Library of Congress. And as I was going through, I noticed that they had a number of boxes of the Chamberlain collection. Apparently, Library of Congress managed to hang on to like four or five boxes of personal mm-hmm. archives and other things. And I went through them. I mean, this is at a time when you still could put on gloves and go through the actual archival material.
Right.
And I found, of all things, personal notebook and address book. And it was just amazing that throughout the war, he had the addresses of thousands of people, the most intriguing of which was, and obviously was a post-war entry, President and Mrs. Ulysses S. Grant in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
An amazing individual. Now, we're running long today, and guess what? I don't care. We're having fun. So let's go ahead and let's talk about the third day, because I think you would agree with me that everybody likes to focus in on Pickett's charge because, you know, as Shelby Foote said in the Civil War series so many years ago, for every Southern boy, it's high noon on July 3rd, and everything is still possible.
Right.
Before the massacre of what happened at Pickett's charge. But what a lot of people don't realize is Pickett's charge was very likely not the point of what Robert E. Lee was doing that day. There were two other actions which really determined the outcome as much or more than Pickett's charge. And let's start with a little piece of ground a lot of people don't notice up on the north end of the line, up in the Fish Hook, a little place called Culp's Hill. Talk a little mm-hmm. bit about that place and the fighting that went on there, not just on the third day, but all 3 days.
Yeah, Culp's Hill was actually wildly popular, you know, amongst early battlefield visitors. In fact, Culp's Hill got more visitation from veterans and visitors than really any other area of the battlefield. You know, and I think that's surprising for a lot of people to hear. Very, very popular. It began waning, though, as time went on, and now, of course, everybody concentrates, you know, on the main battlefield. The first day is sort of on the back burner, you know, and doesn't get nearly the visitation. Everybody wants to see Little Round Top, and everybody wants to see Devil's Den and the angle, you know, where Pickett's Charge supposedly was concentrated. Culp's Hill's kind of forgotten. There's many times they can go up there, even in the summertime, with a lot of people on the battlefield. And you'd be hard-pressed maybe, you know, throughout the course of an hour to see a dozen people, you know, ever go up to Culp's Hill. But it was a very important part of the federal line and sort of that very top part of this fishhook, kind of an inverted fishhook. If you can imagine this fishhook extending from Little Round Top up along Cemetery Ridge and then across Baltimore and Taneytown Roads, curving around Culp's Hill, and then imagine the barb stuck in the area of Spangler Spring. That kind of gives you sort of a visual, you know, of what the federal line ended up being. But along that curve is Culp's Hill, kind of sitting out there on its own, you know, almost. You would think it would be very easy to defend because it was such high ground, but because of that curve, because of the way it's situated, the Confederates are able to attack on several fronts, and that's exactly what they do. When the attacks come on July 2nd and July 3rd, they are from the northwest, the north, and the northeast, down in the area of where Rock Creek crosses east of Culp's Hill. And it's left to some commanders up there to hold that very important part of the line and hold the important arteries that the Federal Army must use in that area, notably the Baltimore Pike. Meade basically has two very important main roads going through his line to his rear that he's going to use to move troops and also supplies, you know, keep his ambulances, his reserve artillery, and that's the Baltimore Pike and the Taneytown Road. And it's crucial to hold the Baltimore Pike in the area of Culp's Hill. To kind of move this along and make a long story short, let me concentrate on a fellow named General George Greene, Pap Greene. I believe he was the oldest federal commander on the field. I think he was 67 years old at Gettysburg. And he really has an engineer's mind. He's a longtime Army veteran. Again, he's the oldest on the field. But maybe that means, too, he's one of the wisest. And he's one of the early proponents of, because of his position, really digging his men in, you know, and making defenses against those Confederate attacks that are going to come on July 2nd and July 3rd from several directions. And his men do just that. He's badly outnumbered, but he has the advantage of the hill and also digging his men in. Almost like trenches, you know, they put logs down, wood, rocks, anything they can possibly use for their defense. And he has the men in the front line shooting while men behind them are constantly loading the muskets and passing them forward. And after these several attacks, you know, he's also stripped of a lot of troops because Meade moves a lot of troops, First Corps men and others, off of the Culp's Hill area and the area of the Baltimore Pike in order to meet those threats that are coming on the southern end of the line. So not only is Greene being attacked on several fronts, but he's losing men, and he's getting more and more outnumbered as time goes on. But in the end, his men are successful on the morning of July 3rd, recapturing breastworks that they had lost to Confederates earlier. They recapture those and retake the positions, and then they're able to hold against those further Confederate attacks that come on July 3rd. Lee had wanted the two attacks, I think, to be simultaneous, and there's, again, a lot of debate about whether, you know, why the attacks were not simultaneous, either between Longstreet's assault, you know. He opened the fighting on July 3rd with the fighting that happens up on Culp's Hill, and again, you know, some of the heaviest casualties come up in that area, and that's one of the reasons why it was so popular with early visitors. But people today, because it's overshadowed by all those other actions, they hardly ever think of Culp's Hill, you know, and don't realize its importance to the battle as a whole and to Meade holding that line that he had.
And then there's the battle that most people never even bother to go and see, the fight, and that is actually East of the main battlefield in a place called the East Fields. And yet, right, that may have been the place where the battle climaxed and was lost by Robert E. Lee, thanks to the actions of an irrational, impetuous, and historically very well-known young cavalry officer, dead last in his class at West Point, set the record for the most demerits and the worst scores of his era. The worst student to ever go to West Point at that point, a young gentleman by the name of George Armstrong Custer. What did he do, and who did he, and what did he do to Jeb Stuart on that third day?
Well, let me kind of set this in context, because if this is something, and you know, from my, I mean, literally decades of studying this because of my interest in the cavalry, will kind of go against the grain of probably a lot of our listeners who believe, and let me just lay it out there, a lot of people think because of sort of the romantic ideals that have, you know, grown post-Gettysburg by not only scholars and writers, but also many participants themselves. Many people think that what happens out on East Cavalry Field on July 3rd, at the same time the Pickett's Charge is going off, they think that it was coordinated with Pickett's Charge, you know, that Jeb Stuart was actually coordinated with the infantry attack that we all know today as Pickett's Charge in the center of the main battlefield. And it has been my determination from looking at everything I can possibly get my hands on that there was absolutely no coordination whatsoever. However, that does not mean that what happens out at East Cavalry Field is not important. And, of course, to the participants of both sides, it was very important. And people get tripped up sometimes by seeing reminiscences and writings by federal cavalry participants out there who wanted to identify themselves as being a part of that grand third day and, you know, the repulse of the Confederates, notably Pickett's Charge, and that they did their part out there, you know, and that will trip up some people who read that and think that, you know, yes, it was coordinated with Pickett's Charge. But George Custer does get a lot of the attention out there because he does lead and personally conduct a couple of the greatest mounted cavalry charges at Gettysburg, or even during the war, for that matter. But Custer was actually not the federal commander on that field. It was Brigadier General David Gregg, who commanded a division of cavalry, the 2nd Division, out there, and he was actually in command. He is the one who convinced Custer to stay in that area with him. Gregg only had about half of his brigade with him. He was badly outnumbered, and Gregg had seen the importance of holding that area, which for him, really where he was set up, was the intersection of the Hanover and Low Dutch roads. And on the morning of July 3rd, David Gregg saw what turned out to be Jeb Stuart's cavalry moving in the area of the York Road off to his north over in his direction. And he knew that that area had to be saved, even though his commander, General Alfred Pleasanton, had ordered Gregg twice to leave that area. Gregg literally disobeyed those orders and decided to stay there. And when Custer is moving through, Custer's division commander was Brigadier General Judson Kilpatrick, who was moving off to the other side of the federal line, the left, you know, with his two brigades. When Custer's moving through, Gregg convinces Custer to stay and literally disobey his own orders. And he ends up staying, and of course, really, you know, conducts the bulk of the fighting with his Michigan Cavalry Brigade, 4 crack brigades of Michigan Cavalry. And they end up repulsing Stuart out there, who really, in my opinion, was just trying to engage Gregg and draw him out. And we can go more, you know, deeper into detail about how and why all that happens, but I think suffice it to be said, Stuart is repulsed that day out there, even though it's not coordinated, you know, with Pickett's Charge. It's one of the rare battlefield defeats that Stuart suffers. Oops, you still there?
Yeah, we just had a little feedback here.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I heard some noise.
Please continue.
Okay. But yeah, you know, like I said, in my opinion, it's something not coordinated with Pickett's Charge that really Jeb Stuart knew that Gregg was in that area, because Jeb Stuart arrived on the battlefield early on the afternoon of July 2nd and saw Gregg there, and then also watched some of the fighting that happened in the area of what we call today Brinkerhoff's Ridge, right along the Hanover Road. Gregg's cavalry fights with elements of the old Stonewall Brigade and literally draws those Confederates out of what would have been the fighting at Culp's Hill at that time. So it probably made an enormous difference on July 2nd in the number of Confederates that are able to assault Culp's Hill. And indirectly, helps save Culp's Hill for the Federals that day. But Jeb Stuart literally sits on his horse for a time in that area after he arrives and after he consulted with Robert E. Lee and saw Gregg's Federal cavalrymen fighting in that area. And the next day, I believe, on July 3rd, meant only to move out in that area, in the area of what we know today as East Cavalryfield, which is encompasses the farm of John Rummel in that area, which still exists today, and wanted to draw Gregg out. And, you know, not something specifically coordinated with Pickett's Charge, but he certainly drew out Gregg and got more than he bargained for in the persona of George Armstrong Custer and his Michigan Cavalry Brigade, and ends up losing that field.
And correct me if I'm wrong, this really represents something important for the Union, especially their cavalry units, because up until Gettysburg, I can't recall terribly many occasions where Union cavalry bested Confederate cavalry, and
right.
Certainly not Jeb Stuart. And Gettysburg kind of destroys the mystique of Jeb Stuart and establishes a new toughness and a new authority for Federal cavalry, does it not?
It does, yeah. And it all starts back, you know, on June 9th with the battle at Brandy Station down in Virginia between Jeb Stuart and Alfred Pleasanton's Federal cavalry. Up until that time, the reason that you can't think of, you know, many instances where cavalry on both sides goes toe-to-toe is because the Federal commanders before kept the Federal cavalry broken up. And, you know, not only were brigades broken up, but regiments even were broken up. You had a couple of companies here, a squadron of companies there, you know, with Federal commanders acting as couriers and scouts and so forth. They were not a cohesive strike force until January of 1863, when the Federal Army commander at the time, General Joseph Hooker, reorganizes the Army. And, of course, that's when he consolidates the different corps. He gives them the corps symbols, you know, which gives them an identity that these veterans carry through, not only through the war, but in their post-war lives. You know, the big thing that they identify with are the corps symbols that they were given. They wear them on their uniform. They're on their monuments today, you know, Gettysburg and other fields. They're prominently displayed on the monuments. But he gives the cavalry an identity by bringing it together as a cohesive strike force, an offensive force, that then is going to start going toe-to-toe with Jeb Stuart's Confederates. And, again, I said it all starts June the 9th when Alfred Pleasanton is ordered by Hooker to go across the Rappahannock River down in the area of Brandy Station and Fleetwood Hill and Culpeper, where they expect, you know, the Confederates to be concentrated, and break up Jeb Stuart's cavalry. Well, Jeb Stuart is camped around the area of Brandy Station and Fleetwood Hill, so he's a little further north, you know, towards the river than Pleasanton expected. So the fighting really starts when they cross the river. But after 14 hours, solid 14 hours of fighting on June the 9th, and they go toe-to-toe with the Confederate cavalry, Stuart and his men still hold that battlefield, but the Federals put up a fight of their own and basically fight them to a standstill for the very first time, you know, in the war. And even the Confederates, I think it was one of Stuart's staff officers, H.B. McClellan, who later wrote in his reminiscences that it was the first time, you know, that we looked at the Federal cavalry as one that could hold its own, as a strike force that we were going to have to contend with, you know, as long as the war lasted. And the Federal cavalrymen looked at themselves for the first time as a, you know, a force to be reckoned with, and it really changes things. Later on in June, during the fighting in the valley, there are times when Stuart is bested on the field. You know, he remembers his old comrades in the 2nd Dragoons and writes to his wife Flora, in fact, you know, that the 2nd Dragoons, quote, tried very hard to kill me today. He's starting to see a change. You know, he really got ripped by a lot of the Southern newspapers for the surprise of Brandy Station. And many people thought that the aura of the great cavalier Jeb Stuart was over. you know, that he's nothing but a flamboyant, pompous officer, you know, and maybe he shouldn't be in command anymore. You know, there were some that actually called for him to be removed from command. But, of course, Lee stuck with him. But things really changed starting in June of 1863, and we see that again, like you say, at East Caffrey Field.
We've got about 5 minutes to finish up our discussion of Gettysburg, so let's talk a little bit about the park itself.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this has been a year where the park complex has been heavily trafficked and probably suffered more than its share of wear and tear from all the people who have come and enjoyed it. What kind of shape is the park in as we sit here today, and what can a visitor over the next couple of years expect to see that's new and different from what was there for the 150th anniversary this past year?
Well, for me, John, it's better than I've ever seen it. You know, in all the years that I've been visiting, I think a lot of that has to do not only with, you know, the great upkeep of it. I think the National Park Service realizes that it's a jewel, you know, in their crown. And it gets more visitation than any other historical spot, you know, except for, you know, maybe Washington, D.C., if you look at it, you know, in a general sense. But something like 2 million people visit Gettysburg every year. This is a town of a few thousand people, you know, surrounded by a battlefield. So you can just imagine the humanity that goes through there every year and what the logistics of the upkeep must be. But I mentioned early on in the show about trying to get the feel back to the vistas that the soldiers would have seen back in 1863 with a lot of the tree cutting and actually planting a lot of trees, planting those historic orchards that existed back at the time. And what it means to us today is it really gives us a better ability to look at the field and see what the soldiers saw. And it's totally about interpretation. You know, you want to be able as best you can to stand there and see what Lee saw, what Longstreet saw, what Meade saw, what Chamberlain saw, you know, what all of these different commanders and soldiers had to deal with. I've told many people that, you know, the name of it is Gettysburg National Military Park. It's not Yellowstone. You know, it's not all about trees and birds and all that, although it's important. And a lot of people, you know, really got very abrasive and very angry when, you know, they started cutting down all these trees. But people have to realize it's all about what happened there. You know, it's to honor what the men did there, the sacrifices that were made, and even to recognize the cowards, too. You know, there's both sides of it. They all are interesting stories, but it's better than it's ever looked, you know, especially for interpretation. I think in the years ahead, people can probably look forward to even more, you know, better vistas, getting a sense of being able to see that field like they saw it 150 years ago. They're doing incredible work in preserving the houses, you know, and buildings and so forth that existed at the time. And you know, it's all in the environment of really a thriving town, you know, right in the middle of this too. So the residents, the people there have to deal with it all the time. It's a horse of a different color. You know, for those residents, it really is. They have to deal with that. But we have to hope that people keep visiting, keep learning, keep going there and, you know, and honoring what took place and remember our history and also support the local people too. You know, I've always said, you know, the local merchants and the people there that literally make a living, you know, off of what happened there 150 years ago have to be supported. So it's something that we can keep enjoying and get our kids.
It's kind of unusual as compared to the Battlefield Park at Antietam. There's a working town in the middle of it. There was a working
right.
town there 150 years ago. There's still a working town there.
Right, right. Exactly. And it's, you know, you got to hand it to, like, the Antietam area and, the, you know, the county that doesn't allow a lot of businesses to come in. You know, it's kind of difficult if you're there, you know, and you want a good meal, you can go into Sharpsburg and, you know, there's some great restaurants and all. But if you want a hotel room, you know, you got to travel. You got to find a place to sleep. Gettysburg, you know, there's fast food restaurants and some things have even come down, you know, which are on the edge of the National Park Service land, which is good. You know, you don't want to see anybody hurt, but I mean, when somebody gives up a certain business or something moves out, and if they're able to reclaim that land, you know, then it's great. But yeah, there's a thriving town right in the center. I mean, Gettysburg is the hole in the donut. You know, when you're looking at the parkland that surrounds them. And so it's something completely different, you know, that they have to deal with residents and businesses and all that in conjunction with, you know, maintaining one of the most visited places in the United States. And it's not easy sometimes. It's not easy, but you got to hand it to them for what they've done so far and what they're going to continue doing.
We're almost out of time here, but I wanted to ask you to take a minute or two and talk about what your next project is. You mentioned Antietam. You're going to do a book or two on that battlefield next, correct?
Correct, right. I'm one of the luckiest guys in the world in that I have a great working relationship and partnership with a fellow named Steve Stamm. And many people, you know, will recognize his work as soon as they see one of the maps that he creates. And our partnership goes back to the Complete Gettysburg Guide that we came out with in 2009. It's that guide to Gettysburg and many things, you know, about the battlefield that visitors hopefully will find very useful, you know, and opening up a whole lot of new things about Gettysburg to them. But one of the things that makes it, I think, so attractive and user-friendly is the fact that it's all in full color and features the complete design and maps by Steve Stanley. Our wonderful publisher, Savas Beatty, and the managing director, Ted Savas, has given us a lot of, you know, leeway in designing those books. And Steve and I have done two more since, a handbook study of the Gettysburg campaign, and then also our most recent book, which is a casualty and order of battle study of the entire campaign. We're now doing those three books for Antietam and the Maryland campaign. We're going to do a guide. We're going to do a handbook of a lot of, you know, interesting facts and trivia and so forth for the campaign, and then also a casualty study. And all of them are going to feature the maps and the design done by Steve. And they not only look good, it makes them user-friendly just because of the way he sets them up. And, of course, nobody makes maps like Steve Stanley. The guy is a hard worker, and it's amazing the detail he's able to put in there. But people just love his maps, you know, for good reason. And like I said, I'm the luckiest guy in the world to be able to work with him and you know, to be able to reap the benefits of his design and his maps and then hence pass that on to everybody that's able to use them. So that's what we got coming next. We're actually moving off of Gettysburg and on to Antietam, which is kind of my second love of the Civil War. I'm really excited to be, you know, right in the middle of doing these books. We hope to have them out next year. So,
David, I want to thank you for coming on. I hope you'll please accept an invitation to come back and talk to us when you get the first of the Antietam books done. Thank you for sharing, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
John, I'd love to. Thank you so much. It's been great.
My pleasure. And with that, we come to the end of our last show of 2013. I want to go and thank all the people who have helped us here at RightStream and on Military Monday to go and build this show. We started back in March with an idea. Frankly, I had no idea how to be a radio host, much less how to run a internet-based radio board on Blog Talk Radio, but as we've moved forward, we've gotten better and better at it, and I just want to say thank you to everyone, and I hope that you'll join us beginning next year. We've already got some great shows planned, and again, thank you, Happy New Year, be safe, and I look forward to being with you next week on Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV and a man with a gun.